is why we do, because we've only got 20 minutes anyway. So there's not an official Adorno person, right? Or is there?
Yeah,
who?
Yeah, there's somebody on each.
No.
No. Okay. Well, I can be the Adorno person. Did you all read the Adorno?
Yeah.
It was an interesting. It was an interesting experience for me because I've always, well, not always, but until reading that and other stuff written about that time, I was always of the opinion that the kind of the more media out there, and particularly interactive media. And more means of media production are in people's hands and stuff, that the smarter and more powerful people would be. And here is a guy who pretty accurately seemed to describe both the strip mallscape of modern America and the sort of commercial reality of American media, you know, 50, 60 years before it happened. I mean, if anything, to me, it feels like we're just on the cusp, that we're on the lip of falling into the thing that he's describing way back then. Did it feel like a nightmare scenario to you? Did it feel like almost an accurate description, that there's no way out?
No, I thought, he lost my, like, my paragraph two, I was like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
Because?
Because he has no, like, he sets out a system that he, that's like kind of omnipresent without constructing how it actually exists. Like he never proves its existence, but he's like, you know, and he's a Marxist, so he's like.
So you feel as he didn't provide a good enough foundation given circumstances to.
Well, it's the same problem that almost all Marxists have is that they're like okay, there's this capitalism thing, but they don't tell you how it actually exists as a unified system, right? They say there's the system at work, but
so,
like,
and for you, without him justifying that, the rest of it falls flat. Okay, step that part there. Yeah.
I thought that this was supposed to be a reaction to like the idea that all rationale is based on reason. Like there's true reason in you, but you react based on the reason that's inherent inside of you. Like if this was a reaction to Kant, which was sort of taken from Nietzsche. So he's saying, like, you need to, like, if this is the first postmodern idea of how you address being in a system. Like, you can exist in a system, but you know you're in sort of like this discussion I always come back to, like, how can you describe the fishbowl if you're in the water? But in many ways, he sort of is just very upset and reacting to this idea that, like, we aren't pure reason. Like, look at all of these things that are occurring. Like, you can see them happening, so why can't we stop them? He just seems really frustrated. And, for example, he says, like, if I were to be, he lists the steel, petroleum, electricity, and chemicals as these industry leaders. Like, do you feel that that's the same scenario now? Do you feel that steel, petroleum, electricity, and chemicals are ruling what we see and what we perceive as like the top, or is it now media? Because I mean, that's really what this class is getting at. Like, there are these hidden, I mean, you said it in your documentary, there's these hidden six companies that are starting to conglomerate and control these things. And that just is very parallel to what he's saying about.
Well, and who owned them finally?
The
GE.
So,
you know, steel and oil.
So, like, is that applicable now? Is this still
yeah,
true?
I don't think so. I don't think it's the media feminism. I think it's exactly that. But it's exactly what he says in here, and that those are the core companies. That's the highest level of power, and then the media below it is has high power, but it's really only to serve those needs. I mean, everything in terms of consumerism, you break it down to, you know, what it takes. All the products down to their base, what do they share most in common is raw elements and materials, and then those are the companies where everything is funneled through. It doesn't matter what you do with it, if it involves
so
chemicals or if it involves
so the,
steel.
Right, so the end of The Persuaders, we're told by by the heads of advertising, look, this is a great world people are living in now because they have choice, right? You can go into a supermarket and you've got choice of all these different things. Why doesn't Adorno feel like that's choice?
Because what the guy actually says is, the great thing about this is, as a consumer, you have the choice of what you want to buy. The power has really gone back to the consumer. It's like, well, that's not really much of a choice. If my choice is just what I can buy, like, what if I don't want to buy anything? Is that a choice that I can have? Or what if I like to...
Sure, I'm sure the head of the advertiser, sure, that could be your choice. Not to buy.
No, sure, but to this guy, like, the world begins and ends with consumer choice. Consumer choice is some.
You can choose Adidas, you can choose Nike, you can choose Airwalk, you can choose Simple, you can get Converse.
I almost think there's too much choice.
What's the problem?
And the problem is that it's all flooded by the same two, three, you know, companies.
Well, if there's too much choice, what's that? What's that a technique for?
He says it's prime service to the customer to do his schematizing for him. That is to say, to reason that there is no reason except that which is dictated by the industry. So, I mean, he's right. You can have a choice as a consumer, but you don't choose to be a consumer in the first place. It's dictated.
Right, but even if that's true, so what's so bad about choosing who you are by what you buy? Don't you have infinite possibility there?
You can also make your own crap.
You can buy a crucifix if you believe in Jesus. You can buy a mug in David if you believe in Moses.
It's the assumption that, like Renee was just saying, that, you know, the happy, docile American society rests in consumerism, rests in fulfilling those inner, like, vacuums with products. That's what makes it so bad. So even though you could choose exactly what defines you as a person, you know, for products, that's not really how you should go about it.
Should be, but there's a value judgment. Which is okay, but then we've got to defend it. In other words, what is the problem with, let's just say, we're all taking this course because we want to know how to persuade people, because we want to be hired by companies that'll help us make ads to get them to buy products. And we believe that, so this is where the conversation has moved. Instead of deciding which God they're going to believe in the way they did in the old days, now we're going to help people decide which toothpaste they're going to believe in. And we are going to embed value systems in these products that let people express their deepest longings, hopes, fears, and wants. Where does that break down, at least according to Adorno?
Well, part of it breaks down in that it addresses people as individuals, and the desire is located in you as an individual, and it's very, and this is digital persuaders as well. It's not like, well, what will we all club together and buy and share? Because that's not part of the deal. It's like, what do I want for myself in my house, it's sealing everybody off.
Why does it lead to individualism? Is it because of the appeal or because of the underlying sort of economic reality? Is it because people are being appealed to as individuals in all this media, or is it because you just sell more stuff to people as individuals?
I think most of them were there now, but there was like one sublime that everybody was looking towards. But he's talking about these many sublimes, or many choices, or many, and that's what gives away that all legitimates our individual individuality or ourselves. So ourself could be many things or go to different ways and not to one choice or one sublime.
Is this it? Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry for just carrying on like that. I had it. We ended up doing 2 hours rather than one, so I have to make up for lost time.
Thanks so much.
All right, we'll be in touch.
Go Yankees.
At the end, let me steal this. I mean, there was a weird, bizarre hopelessness at the end of here. Why can't we, at least according to him, as creative individuals, as writers and thinkers, why can't we just make TV shows and books and things that make people aware of all this?
Because it'll be subsumed by the whole. That's the whole thing of the culture industry. There's no... You can rebel against the culture industry and then it'll take your rebellion, it'll put its bollocks off and then it'll take it in so that you can't be outside it. It will eventually, you know, and I mean, on a normal basis, you can see that in the kind of the normal rant about like, oh, you start off, or even stuff you said about your own books. Like, I wrote these books, and I was kind of pointing out to people what was going to happen, and blah, 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 and then people are like, oh my god, that's so amazing, I can use this to sell stuff. And then everything will become, or like punk, or like zines, or any underground thing that becomes appropriate, it's found, and then it's appropriated, and it's taken over, and then it's ruined. I mean, that's a very common sort of 20th century cycle that everyone's familiar with, and that's... to me, I mean, I think that's what Adorno is talking about. You think, you know, they'll find the resistance and then they'll appropriate it.
I mean, he does seem to be describing sort of the culture of American Idol, say. That would be something that I think he saw us moving towards, is this thing that looks like democracy and everybody's voting and we all get to choose from the 10 contestants of which one we like. So isn't this the expression of American musical taste, and Coke is supporting it with their beautiful red couch, and it's all, on the one hand, it's the great American dream. I mean, I think that's the for me, one of the brilliant things is the title. I mean, this idea of enlightenment as mass deception. I mean, the enlightenment being the invention of democracy and the invention of the individual, the invention of free will, that free will has become part of this thing.
But what isn't mentioned here, and also I feel like we really should be getting to in this class, is like where did that change occur? At what point, what was the catalyst that made us move into a culture? Because we were democratic for a period of years.
In America, you mean, or in the world?
In the world. Like, the idea of democracy had existed, like, even if you want to say it was a republic, like a republican democracy, but there is something in all of these writings and all of the documentaries that we watch that say, like, we are stuck in this cycle. But where did the cycle start?
So you think there's a moment, you think there's a moment of origin that's, I mean, the Greeks didn't have democracy, right? I mean, they had democracy for all white, free men.
Right. On land,
not for the slaves.
What is we? Are we talking the word? For,
what does it even mean? I mean,
is the French Revolution democracy? I mean,
for everyone whose head wasn't cut off, yeah.
Is that what? The thing is, anybody who cut someone's head, the next year their head was cut off. So
yeah, well,
for his business, cutting someone's head. But if that's democracy, then that couldn't sustain itself for long enough, and then it only became what we call democracy today after people stopped cutting each other's heads off every time they
didn't
like what they
say. I just say like democracy in terms of like being okay, forget I said democracy, but the idea of free will existed but was never, it was once it was written down,
because
then we
discuss
it. Then we discuss it. But where is that point where do you go to? Where can you say this is where it started?
Well, the place I would put it is in the Renaissance. The idea of the individual was born and Faust as a character was invented, a person with will as an individual, and we developed, you know, perspective painting, the idea that we have individual perspectives, and that's sort of where the individual got born, and then we got the Enlightenment, came right out of the Renaissance, where if we all have our individual perspectives, then we should each have a right to express that perspective through some democratic process, and the Greek idea of democracy was reborn. But almost as soon as that happened, then, as soon as this idea of democracy became conscious, then so too becomes the campaign. Then if we are going to be democratic and all that, rather than now just strong-arming people or subjecting them to my terror, now what I want to do is get them to believe that they are choosing me, or I want to get them to choose me. So now power has become a popularity contest.
Do you think, though, I mean, Adorno is clearly suggesting in the culture industry that at some point in the recent past there was a more democratic and a more fair economic environment that wasn't as monopolistic and wasn't as corrupt. So you're saying that hasn't ever existed.
I don't think he actually believes that. I think he's very critical of the natures of societies. I think what he's...
In that particular article, it is implied
that
the...
I think what he's implying is that there's... I think he's responding to an overriding rhetoric of his period, which is that things are getting better and democratic and go America and choice and
in
money...
1944? That's
well,
the part that gets really
World
with
War
me.
II time.
Yeah, it's like he's writing and there's a world war going on. If I got my history correct, he was in L.A., right?
He's in L.A. at the time.
Yeah, I mean, he'd been kicked out of Europe,
right.
Fled Europe, and he's like in L.A., like being like, "What the hell is going on here?" And there's a world war going on. And he's not.
And
a very
fascism
happy
was
dude.
Seen as corporatism at the time.
Well, maybe he was reacting to the propaganda as well. Like everyone, you know, go America, and he was able to be conscious of the fact because he was a foreigner that you know all of the things that they say are going really well, all of the publicity and PR. He's like, no, it's not. There are people, like there are hundreds of people dying every day. That's what is not being addressed, and this could be just a reaction.
Yeah, a lot. Of, I think it's a reaction to LA in a lot of ways.
Apologizing to Adorno is kind of like the point of this. I mean, we don't really know what he was doing. So what's in the article?
Well, we know what he wrote, and it's pretty dystopian, right?
Well, he's been very grouchy. The question is, you know, what he's even grouchy about Jack. You know,
he's always grouchy about Jack.
You never find an Adorno article in which he does not complain about Jack.
And what is he down about? Why is he down on Jack?
Because it has rhythm.
But really.
His historians have attempted to claim, although there is no evidence to back this up anywhere, that he's down on jazz because he's only down on commodified jazz and Glenn Miller and Benny Goodman, but there's actually no evidence to back that up in his writings. But he's down on jazz because he first of all claims that it does not have in this article specifically he goes into talking about how it does not have the discipline of traditional Western classical music, and specifically that everything is based upon this shell of style. You know, it's like everything is style, nothing is actual.
Wait, he's reacting against the culture of cool, you know, the early culture of cool, and he almost sees it as pre-commodified. I mean, it became commodified for the most part, but he sees it as pre- as ripe.
Benny Goodman was pretty commodified, right?
Yeah, but I mean, Thelonious Monk maybe wasn't.
Oh, isn't.
I think people are forgetting his critique of jazz isn't so much for its musical relevance or its interest. I'm sure he's into the idea of jazz as like a folk tradition, but what he's critiquing is like we're no longer in that time, so we remember like jazz was completely infusing pop music throughout the world. Everybody around the world was listening to jazz. It was like something that was completely being distributed through like the machine of the record industry.
Think of it as hip-hop and Sprite.
Exactly. It was the exact same thing. So that's it was his experience of jazz. It's not this sort of esoteric art form.
And he's talking about it because everybody at the time was saying, jazz is so authentic. It's real. It's cool. It's the thing. You know, and he's like, let's look at what it is and how it works now.
But isn't there an element of what the other man is? And I mean, certainly not the idiot thing. I mean, he's right. Like, there's a very, and before I mentioned earlier, there's a very kind of, there's a lot of stuff in the article that makes a lot of sense. And then there's, when you're through it, a lot of things that seem to undermine it, where he's talking, like, his particular, like, rapid vitriol against jazz being one of them, and a general thing about, like, well, in the old days, when people listened to classical music, that was totally great, and that involved loads of discipline, and that involved...
No, but he didn't say that. The whole time he was critiquing the idea of, even the idea of a low art and high art, that people's, like, trying to sort of, like, put higher in pedestal.
He critiques that, and then one of my contention is that he also undermines that by some of his own biases that's what I think.
But you're not listening to the critique of higher and lower. He's saying the fact that something, the lower eating exists, proves that there's something wrong with the general climb of art in society as it is now, that there is even a distinction between the two. And see, he said like that's like a source, like a manifestation of the problem. So he's not saying that high art is this. He said he thinks there's something interesting there, but he's saying like he's trying to take low art in context and say this is a part of the problem that it has become like that.
That it's bifurcated?
And he totally says that high art has always been a bourgeois thing.
Yeah,
and I'm saying
does.
That he's not denying that in any sort of way. So what I'm saying is I guess I'm missing what you're trying to say when I think he accepts the sort of critique that you're trying to pose.
I think in some of what he's doing when he's talking about high art and low art, that his bias is towards the high art thing in the end of it. And I think that when he talks about like the old aesthetic monks and stuff, I do think there's a slightly reactionary thing against the new that isn't necessarily that I think there's a gloominess there that he isn't entirely unbiased in, because I think he's looking back at stuff that he knows, the stuff that's European and stuff that's familiar to him, and I think that his critique of jazz, for example,
I mean, that's probably true. But then you take the idea of asceticism. He's talking about asceticism because he's trying to say in modern society, asceticism has no relevance.
Yeah.
So he's trying to get the reader to think, what is interesting about asceticism besides this sort of like this holy life? How does the idea of asceticism even have value anymore?
Well, he's also concerned, as guys like Baudrillard are, or De Bord, and these kind of people, I think he is concerned with mass deception, with society as a whole disconnecting from reality and then starting to live within the some kind of consumer dream bubble thing, where people are under the illusion that they have all this power through their consumer choices, when actually they're disconnected from anything meaningful. I mean, the high art, low art conversation, it's better expressed these days by guys like Mark Crispin Miller, who wrote the intro to the Bernays book, where he, in The Persuaders, says the problem with having a free media space, meaning a commercially driven media space, is then your media is going to have to serve these commercials. So you're going to end up with a kind of a Muzak-like culture industry that's creating wallpaper for things to be sold rather than shows that are going to make people think or stop or worry. Which is, I mean, for me, is a great argument in some sense for commodified television, for television that costs money, because at least you get what you pay for.
It also connects to aesthetics. I mean, think about the high and low art and connecting with this, the idea that when you're watching Fox News, no matter how horrible the stuff is being said there is, from our perspective, the aesthetics is right on. I mean, they know how to make it look and sound good, as opposed to listening to Jim Lehrer or someone at PBS or listening to public radio, where you don't have that cleanliness, and people today are conditioned.
That all flips, though, and you watch FX, which is a Fox-sponsored media, doing fake handheld home media.
They're not showing the dust. Okay, they're not like this is. That thing is for me as aesthetic as anything else. It's not realistic at all. I mean,
right.
Maybe a filter or something. They're just playing with you. They say, like, giving you a one up on the idea that you think that it's realistic.
Right.
But the true realism is dirty. It has. We don't like it by default. The path of least resistance leads us towards something that's clean and secure and free in a contained environment by getting elements out of whatever they're showing us.
And we get to live in one of Andy Spade's beautiful commercial realities. We can run on a field with those girls and fly on Song Airlines. I mean, on the one hand, it's a great human desire to disconnect from the dirt, the grit, the reality, and move into the Macintosh temple.
Well, that's the path of least resistance. I think that's what he's complaining about. You know, he's complaining that it's so easy to generate that kind of clean aesthetic, if you have money, and then by default people are going to get used to that, and they're going to want to see that all the time, and therefore you're leaving behind all the low art or all the places where they don't have the money to do that, but on the other hand they have the ability to talk about the things that should really be talked about. Also, he grew up in Alto Verde, like in the old world, and for him. There's something. The whole notion of old world seems to me, at least when you visit Europe, is always countering the new world clean aesthetic. I mean, there's something that the parents teach their kids about. Always remember that old world aesthetic as something.
Neil Postman did that here for us. You know, in the 70s. You know, he wrote a book, what's Bridge to the 18th Century or 17th Century, whatever it was. You know, that the excitement over the new and over change and all that is deception, you know, and that we shouldn't adopt new things unconsciously. Okay, I know we got to stop, but I just wanted to let you know, in case you didn't, that my bias, because in The Persuaders, a lot of people ask me by email later how I could end it with that song about how it's happy to go shopping. It ended with a song about it being happy to go shopping sarcastically. Right, I meant with that, and apparently was unclear to a large portion of the audience, that the consumer culture does offer a lot of choices and keeps us cushy, but that very cushiness and a wide array of choice can easily distract us from how disconnected it makes us from one another and from the social reality that might need our attention. While I'm very interested in influence and persuasion, I believe that unconsciously applying every technique we can towards the ends of the market or the ends of our employers is dangerous, wrong, and bad. Just so you know, I want to make sure you knew that as we move on. So if it seems like there's bias in my perspective, I want you to know where that comes from. Okay, next week we do, what do we read? We have to Fog the next week? What do we read?
Yeah.
BJ Fogg, it's just two chapters of Fogg, and then... Right, so find one website that uses what you feel to be persuasive tactics. You know, either as defined by Fogg or as defined by you. And also, for next week, you should know what you're thinking about writing your paper on. So we'll do all that next time. Who wants to talk about or lead us in discussing BJ? Doc. All right. So you have to come.
What?
You have to come next week, Doc.